Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're here with clinical psychologist and weight loss coach, Dr. Imani Dervisala. You've seen Dr. Imani on shows like Dr. Oz or Dr. Drew, and today she joins me to talk about her book, You Are Why You Eat. Her book shows us that weight loss is a much bigger issue than what we think. Losing weight is not just about shedding pounds, but changing your entire life. How often do you feel the need to clean off your entire plate? Who in your life is more limiting to your weight loss progress than a candy bar ever could be? Dr. Imani has some tips on how to not just change your weight, but change your life. Dr. Imani, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Gluck. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. There are so many weight loss coaches and advisors out there. I mean, you cannot pass a book, a place that sells magazines, without some article written about weight loss and about weight control.
Right.
Now, you went through a significant weight loss story, and
yes,
I really want to hear all about it. So why don't you just jump right in and tell us your story?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the punchline is that I lost 85 pounds. So I used to weigh a little over 200 pounds, and obviously I no longer do. And that weight has now been off for over 5 years.
Congratulations.
And for me, the reason I even started the process was I sort of had that tragic wake-up moment, which is often sometimes what gets people going. My child had become very ill. I had been having problems in my marriage. I had been having issues in my career. So all of that together was very overwhelming. And then, surprisingly, I had almost lost track of my body and my weight in the midst of all this chaos. Step on a scale, see that I'm coming in at more than 200. I thought, that seems very unhealthy. Ironically, as hard as taking on weight loss was, it still seemed easier than taking on issues like my problems in my marriage and my issues in my career. So I just started doing it slowly. I thought I wasn't going to tell anybody about it in case I failed. And I did not have the money at the time for trainers or fancy diet plans or any of that nonsense. And I thought, it seems like it's calories in, calories out. So let's change what you eat and let's start a little bit of exercise. And I've never been an exercise person. And interestingly, it started coming off. And within 6 weeks, I had lost 10 pounds. And I thought, this is working. And then it took me 17 months to lose 85 pounds. But in those first 10 pounds, the most important lesson I learned is this had a heck of a lot less to do with what I was eating and a lot more to do with why I was eating. It's when I was eating for reasons that I was trying to please other people, when I was angry, when I was afraid, when I was dealing with emotions, that's when I was going in for the junk. I thought, so it's time to deal with the emotions, and maybe that'll make giving up the junk a little bit easier. And that was the key, and that was sort of the birth of the book for me. The other issue that came up for me in terms of putting the book together, so that was my weight loss story. And let me go back to that, in that what happened was then it got off, and then the hard part began, which is keeping it off. And it wasn't that hard after all, because I remember the key for me, Dr. Gluck, I didn't do some kind of silly, special, fad diet plan. I didn't cut things out of my life. I didn't starve myself. I didn't, you know, eat only fish on days that start with an S or something like that. I simply ate what my body needed, and I learned how to say no. Even if there was still 2/3 of the food on the plate, if I was full, I pushed the plate away, and I walked away. That was the key for me. And like I said, now we're in our sixth year, and the weight's still off.
Well, congratulations. Now, you brought up so many different issues. I'm gonna kind of go through a couple of them. The first is that you went from approximately 140 to 200, and you didn't notice it until you stepped on the scale.
Yes.
Now, that's interesting because some people are so they notice a half a pound, and their entire life is about weight. Now, yours wasn't. How did you, and this is really relevant to so many people who simply don't notice, and some people are hearing this and saying, didn't you like go in front of a mirror, or didn't you notice that you had to buy more clothes?
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Do some people get so caught up in their life that they actually don't recognize the fact that they're blowing up?
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. In fact, I think that's normal. There's a phenomenon out there that's been applied to a lot of things, everything from the space shuttle blowing out of the sky to problems in corporations. I think it applies to human beings, which is what I call creep. And what I mean by creep is it's not like on Monday you weigh 160 and you wake up on Friday and you weigh 180. This is a slow process. Now, anyone could tell you, if somebody said to me, you know, Dr. Romani, you have to gain 10 pounds in 2 weeks, I could do it in a heartbeat. Very easy to put it on. But the fact of the matter is most of us don't eat that gluttonously. And it happens gradually, Dr. Gluck. You know, I mean, you end up taking some shortcuts and maybe you're on a vacation. 5 pounds go on. A few of them come off. You break your foot and you're not active for 6 weeks. 10 pounds come on. It's a slow, gradual process. And what happens is you're like, oh, yeah, I guess I probably these pants are feeling a little tighter, and you might buy a couple of extra pairs. You do these things gradually. And because life is so demanding, for me, for example, at the time, I was dealing with two very small children and lots of other stuff in my life. In some ways, I felt like I had the right to eat the way I wanted. Everything else in my life was on such overdrive or high control. Why couldn't I have one place of pleasure? That's what food had become for me.
It's why pregnant women put on enormous amount of weight, because they figure, yes, I'm pregnant, I deserve this.
I can do what I want to do, and that often did drive me during my pregnancy. I simply didn't care. I've got to tell you, in the years I started putting on the weight, I never thought about what I put in my body. And in fact, I felt entitled to it. And now when I look back, I really realize that that is how I was dealing with so much emotion, like a lot. There was a lot of conflict in my life, and I had not even put word to it, because if I started talking about it, it was too scary. It was too scary to take that stuff on. But I think it's the gradual quality of weight gain that many people will turn around and say, I gained 20 pounds in the last year. 20 pounds is a substantial amount of weight, but because it happened over 52 weeks, it doesn't seem that sudden. And you're right. There are many people out there. I've got to say, I'm one of them. I could tell you probably within a half pound how much I weigh without stepping on a scale. And
right.
So I'm very, very aware now of how much I weigh. I monitor that. I take care of it. I watch what I eat. But the fact is, before that, I paid no attention to it. And all weight management, whether it's the eating, whether it's the exercise, or even knowing your body, is really about mindfulness.
It's funny that you said that, because that was the word that was coming out of my mind. Because when you, mm-hmm, when you gave the illustration of that, sometimes you simply have to say no. Now, there are people who are saying that's a great idea and they could do it. It's really the difference between coaching and what sometimes we need to do something stronger. In my case, it would be hypnosis, where there's a difference between a problem eater and an addict, a person who cannot say no. So tell us, what's the difference for someone who simply is not mindful, not aware of what they're doing, and the person who cannot stop?
Right. The difference between the person is sort of what we call sort of quote-unquote what you're terming the problem eater. That's far, far more common. I think a lot of people would put themselves there and say, every so often I go out, especially on the weekends, and I indulge, and I'll have the burger, or I'll have the pasta, or I'll have the extra piece of cake. But, you know, that might be on a special occasion, and they feel very much in control with it. Or they'll acknowledge, I eat a lot of the kids' foods off their plates, but they feel as though if tomorrow their doctor said your health's in question or they didn't feel good, they could change it. The person who really falls under the rubric of being sort of a quote-unquote food addict is somebody who truly feels out of control with these foods. They crave them. They feel like they need them. They consume them almost every day, if not every day, and they overeat them. And in addition, many times they'll even say that they know that it links to their emotions. They can give you the rhythms and the patterns, but it's the craving. It's the wanting. And that's why it's not surprising that with people who sort of fall under that, you know, that title of the food addict, they tend to go for the sugars, the fats, the salty foods, because those are the foods that act in our brain on those dopamine reward systems that make you want more and more and more. They tend to go for those. They tend to go for those kinds of things.
Right. And one thing that we want to stress is that there is really help for both. See, for some people, it's simply a matter of being mindful, putting things down. You mentioned something before that I thought was quite brilliant, is that you cannot ever feel like you're in a prison. You have to be able to eat so that you feel satiated, satisfied, rewarded, but it's about portion control.
Yes,
for the food addict, it's a much different story. So finding out what's going on neurologically, what is the best treatment plan, whether or not it's you're going for hypnosis, whether or not you're going for some other type of medical intervention, you have to take a look at that. I want you to talk to me about the FLAP test.
FLAB. It's FLAB.
FLAB. Okay. FLAB. What is the FLAB test?
I guess what we're fighting here. And I added an S at the end because there'll be a reason for that. FLABs is a great, and I'm going to tell you sort of two tools that work together. One of the biggest complaints I often struggle with, and I certainly hear from my clients, is they simply say to me, I'm so confused about food that I no longer even know if I'm hungry. It's a great question, because the fact of the matter is we often don't know what our bodies are asking for. We've gotten so cut off from our instincts, or from what I call in the book our spider senses. And so the first question is, am I hungry? And that's a pretty easy thing to answer. I tell people, think about your favorite fruit or vegetable, very healthy food. When you are actually hungry, for me it happens to be apples or mangoes, so we'll use apples. So if you're really hungry, an apple is going to taste fantastic. It's going to take the edge off, and in fact, at those times, you're probably prepared that if somebody puts something healthy in front of you, you'll be able to eat it well. You don't want to get too hungry, but I mean, if you say, I'm hungry, take a moment and ask yourself, will something healthy do the trick? Now, there's sometimes you walk in and say, oh, I'm hungry, I just want to eat, and you say, I don't want an apple, I don't want fruits or vegetables, I want a bag of chips, or I want a donut. You're not hungry then. You're using the food to do something else. And that's where the word FLABS comes into play. In the word FLABS, the F stands for frustrated, the L stands for lonely, the A stands for angry, the B stands for bored, and the S stands for sad. Frustrated, lonely, angry, bored, and sad. These are the five most common reasons people eat for emotional reasons. And when you think about it, think about when it's been late at night, and I even did it last night. I was sort of lonely last night, and I was home alone, and I went and I was wandering around my cabinets, and I grabbed, you know, a granola bar, which probably wasn't a good choice, so sugary late at night. But I could tell you exactly what I was feeling. I was lonely, and I wasn't hungry. And so I had to remind myself of FLABS. I actually have Post-its that say that on my cabinets and my refrigerator to say, give myself that mindful moment and stop myself. If, in fact, you're eating for emotional reasons, the cookie is not going to fix the emotion. In the first 5 seconds, it will, because it's distracting you and it feels good. Then after the cookie's done, not only are you still going to be frustrated, now you're going to be just downright upset because you've eaten all these extra calories you didn't need. So now you get two negative emotions for the price of one cookie. So I tell people, think about if I'm feeling lonely, as I was last night, I think the key would have been, think of something that will help me handle that. Send an email to a friend, make a phone call, do something else that addresses the emotion, because a cookie's not a person. It's not going to address it, just as if you're bored. If you're bored, think of something to do. Eating is not a hobby. It's just a necessary task of survival, but it's not something we do to address boredom. So that's where the FLABS test comes in. So when you go for that junk food, take a moment, ask yourself that question, and if you feel any of those things, take a step back and realize that junk food's not going to take it away.
I think that's a great observation, and I'm going to boil that down into an observation. Now, what you were able to do is you were able to identify that when people eat, for the most part, there's emotional eating, and then there's survival eating. We eat because we're hungry, that's survival, and we eat literally to repress our emotions or to reward or stimulate our emotions. And you came up with a way of logically having your frontal lobe, your cognitive brain, override your emotional brain. And here's the issue for me. Some people do not have the development of their frontal lobe so much in control that they could override their emotions. What do you do for those people?
I agree with you, and that's where it gets a little bit tricky. Number one, though, we know, Dr. Gluck, and if you look at all the research on consciousness formation and on mindfulness, even in a child who literally is in the process of growing their frontal lobes, you can teach some very fundamental mindfulness practices. This is really about putting on the brakes. The frontal lobes are also about putting on the brakes. I mean, that's what they do for our brain. And so I think that it really comes down to, as you're using the term coaching or working closely with someone and teaching them how to say stop. Now, this could be, for example, in some cognitive behavioral models of therapy and whatnot, a more extreme form of this is having somebody put a rubber band around their wrist. And then if they feel like they're going for the thing that's the no, whatever it might be, it could be, you know, it could be a drink, it could be a phone call to a mean ex-boyfriend, or it could be a, you know, it could be a cookie, they snap that rubber band. It hurts. I mean, it catches their attention in that moment. In some ways, that more primitive feeling of pain can help sort of get those frontal lobes primed.
So a little behavior modification there.
Yeah.
Make sure the rubber band is not made out of candy so you don't eat your rubber band.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's...
But what I'm saying is that it's really about it's making it more basic so then you can take it to the next level. But I would find it hard to believe that other than somebody who's actually frankly brain damaged, that you could not bring on mindfulness principles. Now, it's going to be harder with some people. There's no two ways about it. Again, particularly in younger people, adolescents and kids, and even in some adults, for example, a person who's experiencing attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or something, they might find it harder to sort of cut the switch. But I think by and large that it can be overridden. It's just going to take more practice. And you know what, Dr. Gluck? We're all going to make mistakes. We really are. Every single day there's a moment, and I'll say every day I make an emotional eating mistake. That's why one thing I do, I own it. I am not going to stand up in front of a room or on your radio show or anywhere and say, one day you're going to wake up and have this moment where your life is all about kale and chicken. There's not a single day that there's not an emotion that drives me to maybe make some kind of bad choice. For me, it's always boredom and procrastination. And I see that, so I often try to work in places where there's not a lot of food around me, so I won't go for that. But we're going to make the mistakes every day. The key is to minimize them, to stay on top of them, and then sometimes to fix the places we're in. For example, don't keep a bag of junk food in your desk at work. Avoid the coffee break room if you know you go for sweets at 4 p.m. Keep the cookies out of the house if you can. If you have to, lock them up. Because sometimes your frontal lobes are not going to cooperate. When you're tired, when it's late, when you're sad, there are times that you're going to override them. So if you can change the context, you may not go through the trouble of getting in your car for 10 minutes or walking down to the corner store and getting those sweets. So it's like a two-part attack, not just the mindfulness, but also fixing the context. Fixing your house, fixing your office, fixing your car. I've been in people's cars and they look like catering trucks. They just full of junk food.
And how, yeah, one of the things that I stress, and I want your opinion on this, as I stress with my clients, is to take time to visualize how great they're going to look on the beach, how great they're going to look thin, you know, to go clothes shopping and see what it's like to be two or three or four or five sizes smaller. So rather than to be mindful of what is going to happen if you do the wrong thing, to really fixate on how amazing it's going to be if you do the right thing. What's your opinion on that?
I have a mixed opinion on the visualization piece. One of my big concerns is that there's no getting around it. Weight loss in our culture is largely motivated by aesthetics, by looks. Like, I want to look better. And a couple of things can go wrong then, because a lot of people get caught in, once I lose the weight, everything in my life is going to get better. Every boy is going to ask me out on a date, and I'm going to be happy, and I'm going to get promoted. And sometimes these poor people really do lose the weight, and those things don't end up happening because they did none of the internal work. As like I said, this is not a cat we skin just one way. It's really, you have to do this many, many different ways. And I think one thing the visualization can do is, yeah, to say, okay, that I have not been comfortable in my own skin. I'm going to imagine what it's like to be able to wear, for example, that dress to my sister's wedding. But that can't be the only motivator, because a person could starve themselves to any weight. In fact, most diet plans out there, fad diets, diet books, and all this nonsense, are really about a person starving themselves to a goal. And so they get to that goal, but the problem is starvation is not sustainable. And so I think that visualization, and it should be on multiple levels. I actually prefer visualization that's less focused on how a person looks and more focused on how they feel. For example, a person who may be carrying a lot of extra weight and also is not fit. For example, they can't even hike a basic trail with their kids. To visualize standing on top of maybe a local mountain, that was key for me. When I was losing weight, I thought I couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs when I started. Then I got fixated on Yosemite's Half Dome. I said, I'm going to stand on top of Half Dome. I'm going to climb those ladders up to the back. I'm going to climb the ladders up to the top of that sucker, and I'm going to stand on top. It was ridiculous. I couldn't go up a flight of stairs. And would you know, 18 months later, after starting, I got to the top. And that visualization not only made me feel strong and powerful, it's something that could have stayed with me. So I think I totally agree with you on visualization, but I think you got to mix it up. It has to be, for example, I've said to my diabetes patients, I would love for you to visualize not having to take those diabetes meds anymore and type 2 diabetes. I've had more than a few people use the book and get off of diabetes meds. They're like, this is so great to not have to take the meds, to just use diet and exercise and work with closely with their doctors to really find the answer. So I think it's for an older person. They say, I want to be able to run after my grandkids. Oftentimes I just sit there. That becomes the visualization. So yeah, I do think visualization helps, but it's to really mix it up.
And I completely agree that you have to mix it up. The one thing that, though, I do, it's not that I disagree, is that I want to make this comment that one could eat constantly throughout the day, eat good food, fish, chicken, eggs, a ton of vegetables that are negative, that are actually negative calorie foods. They burn more calories than they actually contain, and not feel hungry, and not feel starved, and not feel deprived. That one does not have to starve themselves. In fact, if you starve yourself, you're not only going to not lose weight, but if you lose it, you're going to put back more weight than you began.
Absolutely.
You know, so I encourage my clients to eat 6 meals a day, small portions of really healthy foods that they like and they enjoy, and it's made in a proper way. But it's about portion control, and it's about quality, and it's about eating slowly and enjoying it. And I don't want people to think that starvation is what you need to do to lose weight.
No, and not only is it not, I'm going to tell you the darkest of dark sides on the back end of starvation. I have several patients I've worked with in my practice and continue to do so who come to me having lost 50, 60, 80 pounds. And what they would do is they would purchase someone else's weight loss plan at thousands of dollars. Sometimes they involved special meals, sometimes they didn't. But they all had one thing in common. They underfed them. I had one client who was on a 600-calorie-a-day regimen. 600 calories a day.
That's absurd.
And she did that for 9 months. And you better believe she lost 95 pounds in 8 months. Now she has a dangerous eating disorder. And it has caused her more psychological harm and damage than you could possibly imagine. What happens is that the fact of the matter is, Dr. Gluck, there is a weight our body likes to sit at. If we feed it well and healthy, it'll sit at that weight. Unfortunately, sometimes that set point is not always the way we want to look. And in order to sort of stay as the size 0 or the size 2, sort of the unnaturally small weight, we do sometimes have to deprive ourselves. That's where it starts to get tricky. And that's my concern, where when people really follow these overly structured, starvation-oriented or fast-oriented or food restriction-oriented diet plans, they're not sustainable. But what happens is the person gets a little bit crazy at the back end because they're so terrified to gain the weight back, and yet they were given a plan that can't be maintained in the long term. So as soon as they relax it a little, they very quickly start putting the weight back on, and it's terrifying for them. And it really incenses me, because these people, most of us who have been overweight, we're already disconnected from our instincts. Going on someone's quote-unquote diet plan even disconnects you farther from your instincts. No one else on the planet can tell you how to eat, just as no one else on the planet can tell you how to live or how to love. These are things you have to trust from your heart.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. In fact, I think that any diet per se is actually the wrong way to go. I think it's about choosing a lifestyle that's within your culture, within the things that you desire, and that to moderate. I've seen my clients lose literally hundreds of pounds, and some who needed to, and others, by eating 3,500 calories a day, but eating at the right times, eating very low glycemic foods, having a reasonable exercise plan, getting 8 hours of sleep, drinking a lot of water, keeping their metabolic rate high, so that even though they're eating a good amount of food and they're not hungry, they're not, you know, they're not starving themselves. Because starvation, to be honest with you, it's interesting. You mentioned your client lost that weight. Some people could eat 600-700 calories and they simply won't lose weight. And you brought up something that also was actually extremely important, is that you need to ask yourself, what is weight in regards to your own identity? Is it about health? Is it about the way you feel you have self-worth? You know, we go back to the core symbolism thousands of years. Yes, women did and do get attention through their beauty. When I find that men come to my practice in order for weight loss, it's almost always about health and not about looks, especially if they're in their 40s and 50s. They just don't want to drop dead. But I think that every person has to ask themselves, what is this all about? And then, you know, hopefully working with themselves or with a professional like yourself to find out that, you know, you're more than just your body.
Yes, you
know,
you
to
are.
Develop Absolutely. Things about yourself that you really love outside of only it being about your body.
You know, but Dr. Gluck, I 150% agree with you. That's how I work with my clients. But that's also a really, really hard mountain to climb in our culture. There's television shows out there called The Biggest Loser and The Face and America's Model and all that. There's very few shows out there called The Mind or The Soul. We don't even make that an important part of the discourse in our culture. So we have to. I almost feel like people like you and me have to create these almost rebellions and these revolutions.
You want to make a TV show with me?
Stuff. I'm sorry?
Let's make a TV show.
There you go. I always said my favorite TV show would be called The Mind. Let's see how much, like, if in 10 weeks, just like they make these girls lose lots of weight and look pretty, can I have, you know, give me a 10-week series, and I would turn someone's mind around, turn it into something where they make powerful change in the world, powerful change in themselves, and it has nothing. And you know what? At the end of that 10 weeks to the world, they'd also appear more beautiful. When you're living a real and authentic life, that is that's a dress, that's makeup, that's hair, that's something that no one can put on you. You walk around, and it doesn't matter if you go out in your sweats, which I'm about to do in a little while to exercise, always a big smile plastered on my face, because to me, the health I found through this process has been my gift, and every single day is filled with joy, not necessarily cookies. So it feels great. It feels great. I think everyone can get there, but like I said, it really means like a big change from how we think about what life should look like. We're so caught up in how we look that we lose a lot of it. And I just think that's a really important thing. And, you know, you made another interesting point about men. I think it's become a little bit of a transition, because I think what's gotten harder for men is we are a very image-conscious society. And while men have often been motivated by health, more and more also are being motivated by look. They want the six-pack this and the arms like that. And I'm seeing more and more men with eating disorders in my practice who are really struggling with, there's lots of yummy food out there, but I've got this big gut, and they're struggling with it too. So I think that this is a battle everyone's fighting.
And you're right, but normally they're younger men. Normally they're men who
they're
are still
men, yes.
They're
so
still trying to mate. They're not the 50s and 60s who became successful. And yeah, and I completely agree.
Yeah, no, I do think that it's everyone. Everyone's struggling with this. And again, it comes down to the original point that the book is about. At a very early age, we stop listening to our instincts at the table. Very early age. Many times because we were told to clean our plate. Well, when you're 35 or 40 or 50 and you're still cleaning your plate and eating blindly, that's not going to work anymore. And so this book is about changing that and taking it all back. You don't have to clean your plate.
You don't have to clean your plate. That should be the title of your next book.
Well, you know what's funny? The original title of this book was The Dirty Plate Club, and the publisher's like, oh, I don't know. It's not everything you're talking about, but you don't. You don't have to clean your plate, and you don't have to clean it at the table, and you don't have to clean it in life. Sometimes things don't feel right in life. It's okay to change course in the middle of a life. Just, you know, you can do it responsibly, and I'm not telling people to get up and walk away, but you can do it responsibly, and you can take your life back. It's okay.
Now, you mentioned in your book that you wish that we had a food orgasm. And
yes.
So many people who are listening to this saying, what do you mean you wish? We have food orgasms all the time.
You know what? I think we have food foreplay, but I don't think we have food orgasms.
You haven't met some of my patients.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
And my engineer is looking to me saying, you don't get it. I have had it. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny? I have them quite regularly. I am the biggest foodie on the planet. I will try every new restaurant, every new recipe. I love it. But the fact is, what I meant by that statement was, it'd be nice to know when you're done. Let's face it, that moment when you want to just sort of roll over on your back and sort of take a rest and say, I'm clearly finished at this point. And so that's what I was going for, is that there's a moment where you're like, aha, this is it. Okay, great. And there's even like a happy ending, so to speak. And I think what happens is people hit that point of a happy ending, like, I've just eaten something absolutely scrumptious, But because they've put more of the scrumptious on your plate than you can handle, you keep going and going and going, and now it's no longer pleasurable. You're just doing it because you feel like you're supposed to. I mean, I hate to say it, if you have sex out of obligation, it's quite different than if you're...
Happy ending. Are we talking about food massage?
A food massage or food foreplay. What I mean, again, and you said it, eat slowly. Eat things that are healthy and good and taste good. Take your time. One of the things I advise people to do, and I always make this mistake, I wish I was better about it, set the table. Even if you're alone, I'd say I'd probably take half my meals alone. And actually lay out the plate and the fork and the glass, sometimes even light a candle. The more we make food into ceremony, and it deserves ceremony, then what happens is we slow down instead of just eating a sandwich over the sink or while we're sitting in traffic. That's not ceremonious, and so we don't pay attention. The key to mindful eating is to make eating about eating. No other mammal species will eat itself to obesity unless its brain is damaged. You don't see lots and lots of super fat animals. Well, when we feed our dogs, we can make them fat. But the fact is, left to their own devices, they don't. Why? Because when they eat, and then they walk away. And so for us as people, we're playing with our phones, and we're reading the paper, and we're doing everything but eating while we're eating. We watch TV or driving. We're paying attention to the other thing we're doing, not the eating.
And I couldn't agree more. I tell people that the shower is for the shower. The bed is for sleeping. The TV is for watching. Don't eat in front of the TV because you'll eat as long as the show is on. And I love your idea about making food ceremonial, because this way you could serve small portions and you take your time, and it's about the ceremony. I want to jump into something else, and I want your thoughts on this. One of the things that I like people to consider is that we live in an interconnected world where what you do to yourself doesn't just affect you, that there are stakeholders in your weight. You know, there's your children, your lovers, your family, your friends, how you look, how you feel, how your energy level is, how your health is. How important is it to make people aware that their weight is not just their issue?
I think that it is not just you, because it's not just your issue. That's a problem. We learn, early on, eating is something we do with other people, and we do it at the behest of other people. All of these stakeholders, ranging from what I call heavy stakeholders, like mom, dad, husband, wife, children, who weigh in on what you eat. And what I mean by that is they want to eat what they want to eat, when they want to eat it. They expect you to finish everything. If you don't eat the dinner that your spouse made or the dinner that your mom made, now you're hurting their feelings. So now you're eating that extra helping of pasta, not because you're hungry, but because you don't want your mother to cry. And so that's not a reason for eating. And then we sometimes want to please them with our appearance. A woman thinking, if I lose weight, my husband won't leave me. Or a teenage girl thinking, I'm too fat, I need to be skinny, or other kids won't like me. Other people drive this train so much. And I say to people, you don't realize that probably 90% of your meal that you just ate for somebody else. Heck, even the waiter in a restaurant in that moment becomes a stakeholder. How many of us have had a waiter come by who sort of, I think, just doing his or her job, will look at our plate and say, and you didn't finish everything, but you were full and satisfied, and says, hey, didn't you like that? Sometimes people keep eating just to please the waiter, and the waiter is a total stranger. And so we use food to please other people by how we consume it, by how we offer it, all of those things. And these people really have a very powerful hold over our lives. But it's a slippery slope, Dr. Gluck. If we find ourselves eating to please other people, I can guarantee you, you're probably living to please them as well. And you may have some pretty broken spaces in your life that you're maintaining because you don't want to disappoint your mom. Even if your mom could have passed. Your mom may not even exist on this planet anymore, and you're still living to please her.
We're so much on the same page, because at the end of the day, whenever you live to please someone else's life, you end up living their life and not your own. I live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and what happens is, where I live, it's just the opposite, that mothers are scolding their children for eating too much, for eating any sweets whatsoever, that they are limiting their intake of food, that they're beating into their child that only through being thin and fit are they going to become successful and be accepted. That is dangerous as well. Tell me what you think.
That's, again, there's the flip side. Once again, they're telling these children, don't listen to your instincts. You're still hungry? I don't care. You're going to eat the way I tell you. It's just the same as a mom giving her kid too much food. They're taking their kid away from what because children are great at knowing to say, I'm full, and pushing the plate away. It makes me think, and what this does is these mothers are setting their kids up for a disaster. It makes me think about, I have two small children, both of who are at an excellent weight, fit, and in my family, we do have the dirty plate club. If I put too much on their plate, they're like, Mommy, I'm really full. They push it away. I'd say maybe one night out of seven do my kids ever ask for sweets. I mean, they don't really care because they can get them any time. I was at a little party for children, and they were decorating little gingerbread houses, and the hostess of the party had put out all these little bowls of candies and everything for the kids to decorate the houses. You would think these children had never seen sweets before. It looked like, it really looked like vultures. They just were shoving handfuls and handfuls of candy in their mouth because they simply didn't know how to regulate it because it was never part of their lives. And the concern then becomes is one day these kids are going to go to middle school or high school where they have money in their pocket and they're going to be able to make their own choices. And I can tell you, they ain't going to go for the salad. They're going to go for the cookies because they taste good. That's what middle school brains and bodies love. They love that taste and everything like that. And they're not going to know how to regulate it because somebody didn't say to them, one cookie good, three cookies bad. For these moms, it's no cookies ever. And what you do, our job as parents is not only to gatekeep from them, but also to teach them how to regulate the foods that are a little bit tricky, like sweets. And what I do is I keep them in my house. And we talk about healthy choices first. Let's think about how our tummies feel. And then if you want something more, we'll put a healthy portion of sweets in front of you. My children have never been dysregulated about sweets. And honestly, my house is full of them.
And so this is a great example of, you know, my particular pet theory is that all fanaticism is inherently destructive.
Absolutely.
That moderation is the best. I want to go back to something you said that animals won't eat themselves to death. Now, having said that, if you take a rabbit, you take a mouse, and you give them cocaine, they will actually use the drug till they die. And
yes,
it's important for parents when they give their children food to make sure they're giving them food that is really from nature, not with a lot of additives, you know, not with a lot of sugar, just really good, healthy food, and then the child will regulate themselves.
Yes, they will. This is where I think we have a lot of sloppy parenting in our culture. What we do is we hyper-control ourselves with our kids sometimes, and then we want to be able to go do our own thing. Because, again, I think we are pretty selfish at times, and sometimes in parenting, it's intense. You got to be on your game 24 hours a day. As a parent, your job when it comes to nutrition, it's a difficult one because, as you said, you need to put healthy, balanced, well-proportioned meals in front of your kids, teach them how to put healthy portions in front of themselves. But it's your job to make sure those things are made available. And then if your kid does only eat a few bites and says, really, I'm full right now, and pushes it away, yeah, it's your job in an hour or two to make sure that they're not going for junky stuff, that, you know, you bring the healthy stuff in. Maybe they say, I am hungry in an hour or two. Sure, here's some fruit or here's something else that's healthy. That's your job. You are a gatekeeper. And I think that it can get intense, but fanaticism, as you said, to me, fanaticism is what people engage in when they feel out of control. And I think we as a society feel completely out of control with food. It's everywhere. It's everywhere, and it's a cheap fix. And so whether you have a dollar or $100,000, whether you're eating at a gourmet restaurant or a fast food restaurant, it's always up in our face. And I think people feel so out of control with it, they go to extremes, whether it's complete starvation or complete binging, rather than finding that middle road. And this can have real harm on our kids.
I absolutely agree. I would say this. I would say that we also have to take a look at ourselves or our children and see whether or not there's a difference between a weight problem, a food disorder, or a true addiction. In the same way that if a person has a deep addiction, I probably wouldn't suggest that they would keep a lot of candies and cakes in their house.
No, I agree. Well, that, and there's the knowing. Again, Dr. Gluck, it keeps coming back to everyone knowing themselves. I've known people who say, I can handle, you know, chips or crackers in my house, but I can't handle there being a cake in my house, to which I say, then don't keep a cake in your house. because you know what? There'll be plenty of cakes outside of your house. You'll get invited to a birthday party, or there'll be one at work. I always say to people, the junk food will always find you. I'm not talking about a life of austerity, but I say don't invite it in. It's like don't invite the problem in, because it'll find you, and you'll enjoy it. And because it's not in your house, you'll have that piece of cake for your friend's birthday and enjoy it, because that's probably the only piece you're going to have for a couple of weeks. But if you have it in your house, you're in trouble. And I agree, everyone has sort of their food, their item that's going to cause them trouble. And I'll tell you, when I'm in the grocery store and I'm a little bit hungry, when I go to reach for that box of cookies, say I have to say out loud, Romani, if this box is in the house, you're going to eat it. And out loud, probably people in the store think I'm a little nutty, I put it right back on the shelf, because I know that if it's here, I'm going to eat it. And so some things I know I can't handle, Oreos or something like that, and I won't keep them in the house. So if you've got to know yourself, you've got to know your kids. That's a fact. And sometimes there's no one-size-fits-all strategy here.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, a good point, that for each and every person, there's no one lifestyle plan. There's no one approach. Some people, coaching work. Some people, you know, they do amazing with hypnosis. Others, they simply need to really kick up their exercise program.
Yeah.
That at the end of the day, we're really trying to make sure that the shoe fits the person we're trying to put it on to.
Yes.
We could go on and on, but time does not allow. It's been an absolute pleasure. And when we do our outro, I'm going to tell everyone where they could find your book and buy your book. And they absolutely should, because it's a great book with a great story.
I really appreciate it, Dr. Gluck. Thank you. This is a great conversation.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too now. Bye.
Thanks.
I truly want to thank you, Dr. Romani, for coming on our show. I want everyone to go out and get a copy of her book, You Are Why You Eat, on Amazon.com. I want you to go to her website. It's Dr., spelled out D-O-C-T-O-R, and there's a dash, Romani, R-A-M-A-N-I.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every single problem, there is a solution, and I am your problem solver. Please check out our other episodes on www.gluckradio.com or on wabcradio.com. There is truly something for everyone. You will not be able to pull yourself away. Don't forget to tell a friend. They'll appreciate it. You like us on Facebook. If you have an idea for our show, if you want to be on our show and you think you have a story that's good enough, or you'd like to sponsor a show, you call us at 212-599-3195. Till next time.